Well, as I mentioned, I'll be in Roswell, New Mexico for their 2007 UFO Festival, and it is going to be one heck of an event. In the July 6th Friday night program, I will be there doing it live in Roswell as we try to unravel that incredible story. And physicist and researcher Stanton Friedman will be there as well, along with some other guests, and he is next on Coast to Coast AM. Stanton Friedman, he received his Bachelor of Science degree, Master of Science degrees in physics from the University of Chicago. That was back in 55 and 56, where Carl Sagan was a classmate. He worked for 14 years as a nuclear physicist for major companies on highly classified. He eventually canceled projects as nuclear aircraft, fusion rockets, nuclear power plants for space. Since 1967, Stanton has lectured on the topics of UFOs at more than 600 colleges and more than 100 professional groups in 50 states, 9 provinces, England, Italy, Germany, Holland, France, Finland, Brazil, Australia, Korea, Mexico, Turkey, almost the entire planet, actually. Often referred to as the father of Roswell, and I've now coined the phrase, the father of modern-day ufology, Stan was the first to investigate the incident beginning in 1978. He has been investigating UFO incidents since the mid-1950s. Our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hey, Stanton, how are you?
Well, considering it's 3 o'clock in the morning here, I'm fine.
But you know what? You have got to be one of the most devoted guests we have, because it doesn't matter what time it is, wherever you are, you're always prepared to do Coast to Coast with us.
Well, you've got a big audience, and I'm out to reach the world, and I don't know of any better way of doing
it. Going to do something special with you tonight, Stanton. An hour of you and me just talking, and then 2 special hours as we continue talking, but we're going to open up the phone lines because I keep getting emails every time you're on the program that I don't give our Coast audience enough time for you and for them to talk. So we're going to do 2 hours of that tonight.
Okay.
I'll
talk fast.
Yeah, well, that's right. What have you been doing since we last talked?
Oh, I've been doing all kinds of things, and this is going to be a big year. I feel it in my bones. One important thing, I guess, I've done a lot of lecturing. I've spoken in the last 5 weeks in New York City, in Pennsylvania, in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, San Marino, Italy, Regina, Saskatchewan. But I also... I'm looking forward. We're finished now with a book that's got my name on it, as well as that of Kathleen Marden. Kathleen is Betty Hill's niece.
Oh, okay.
And the book is Captured! The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, and it'll be out this summer. And, you know, the experience took place in 1961, and most everybody has heard of their abduction in New Hampshire. But... the book, The Interrupted Journey, was a worldwide bestseller in 1966 on a bunch of languages and stuff. But a lot has happened since then. Betty just died a couple of years ago, and Kathy is executrix of her estate and has the tapes, which she has transcribed, and all kinds of correspondence. There's stuff that's never seen the light of day, you understand. And I'm involved. I know some people are thinking, oh, what the heck has he got to do with that? Well, I am old enough, incidentally. I did meet both Betty and Barney Barney's death. And my major contribution to the book is talking about the star map work of Marjorie Fish, which was done after The Interrupted Journey was published, and defending that against the assassins of that particular aspect of the story. Also, I deal with the noisy negativists. You know, the people, there are some debunkers out there who will attack anything because with a case like the Hill case, and somebody once asked me, is there a best case that encompasses everything? And I would point to the Hill case because not only is it the only case I'm aware of which gives us a strong clue as to where these guys originate, but you have a very respectable couple who were examined, if you will, by a very respectable psychiatrist, Dr. Benjamin Simon, who had no interest whatsoever in UFOs, but was an expert at recovering memories from people they didn't call it that then, post-traumatic stress syndrome, but shell-shock war veterans.
Yes, you're right.
From World War II. And I've actually seen the Army movie where he treated lots of people. You know, your buddy's head gets blown off next to you in battle. Some people have trouble integrating that into their future.
That kind of mental trauma, whether it's that
yes.
kind of episode or what the Hills went through, is devastating to someone, and they may not... they may not ever be the same, Stanton, unless they get some severe help.
Yeah, and his expertise was in using medical hypnosis to have people relive, not retell, but relive the experience, no matter how terrifying. And incidentally, one of the things that'll come out in the book is that there was an occasion where Dr. Simon admitted to Dr. James E. McDonald, who I consider the world's finest ufologist,
who he just passed away, didn't he?
No, 1971, I guess it was.
Oh, that's not. Oh, there was another McDonald who just died too. Okay,
there's a book out, Firestorm, by Ann Ruffell about him, an excellent book, and Simon told McDonald that the emotional intensity on occasion with Betty and Barney, separately, of course, was greater than that of any of the war veterans he had treated. And that's a pretty spectacular statement when you think about it, considering the broad spectrum of people that Simon had dealt with. Remember, this is a guy who didn't know anything about UFOs, didn't care anything about UFOs. Anyway, so that book will be out. It'll be available at the Mutual UFO Network Symposium this coming August, 10th through the 12th. Both Kathy and I are speaking there. She'll be talking about the Hills. I'll be talking about Roswell, would you believe?
Which you and I will talk about when I'm there in Roswell on July 6th.
Yeah, I'm doing a couple lectures at the museum and on a panel and doing meet and greets and signings in the morning. Hopefully I'll be able to sign. I don't think Captured might be available there, but the publisher just doesn't know at this point in time.
I'm still laughing, Stanton, over the picture you sent me years ago with you being the Grand Marshal in the Roswell, New Mexico parade.
Sitting
that in
that was
car.
Pretty funny. Well, yeah. They love me in Roswell, and you know, and I don't even get a cut of the take, so to speak.
Well, you know, I interviewed you in 1971. You and I have talked about this before at Oakland University in the northern area past Detroit. And in that year also, right after I got done interviewing you, Stanton, when you were there for one of your college speeches, and you had mentioned the Barney and Betty Hill case, which I had learned about in the Look magazine article several years before that. I went back to my studio the next day and interviewed via phone Benjamin Simon.
And I didn't know that.
Yes, and I cannot find the tape, Stan, but I've got to tell you, many of the things you say, he echoed. You know, he opened up to me. It was a lengthy interview that I turned into a special one-hour show. And he just told me this incredible thing about how he was shocked to hear their versions, which were very similar. You know, he wasn't, like you say, he wasn't into UFOs. He didn't know anything about that. And when he started questioning them as a medical practitioner, he just when I say couldn't believe it, I say that in an awe phrase, he was in shock.
Well, I've just learned something new, even at my age, George. I'm glad.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's go back a little bit. The brand new planet discovered this week, and people are saying that it's got the potential for life because of its complexity. What do you think?
Well, I read the original scientific publication, and I read a whole bunch of, let's call them news articles about it. It's an exciting find. There's been some overstatement about it, George. The thing is that, yes, we know this planet, Gliese 581c, is only, five times the mass of Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that it's very close to its dwarf star, one of the reasons that they're looking at dwarf stars is because they're much smaller than normal stars, they put out less energy, but also their path through the heavens is more influenced by their planets than a much larger star would be. So it's easier to measure. And this thing, its orbit around the star is only 13 days, if you can imagine that, as opposed to a year. On the other hand, there's a lot of guesswork going on. We don't know the diameter of the planet. Yes, it's larger than Earth, but not a heck of a lot larger. It's not a Jupiter-sized planet. And we know that it could conceivably be a rocky planet, but people forget that size alone or mass alone isn't enough to say, oh, yeah, that's where life is. Consider in our own solar system, there's Venus, which is roughly the same size as Earth. Earth's a little denser, a few more heavy metals, but it's closer to the sun. But Venus has an enormous gas effect, that is, greenhouse effect, is what I'm trying to say. And it's about 600 degrees the atmosphere. A dense planet will have a large atmosphere. This thing could be literally hotter than hell, George.
Yeah, absolutely. But what it does tell you, though, Stan, is that the possibilities are out there. They're endless.
Well, yeah, the key thing here is that unlike, say, 40 years ago, where we don't know that there are any other planets in the universe, and maybe ours is the solar system is the only one with planets, everywhere we look, there are planets. And, you know, our measuring techniques are getting better. Much better with time, and I'm sure we'll find a host more, but we got to be careful. They haven't shown that it is a rocky planet or that it does have water there, put it in quotes, you know, an Earth-like planet. It's the closest to that so far, but, you know, I'm not betting anything on whether there is or isn't life there. Or what the surface of this body will be like. We just don't know. But it's good that people are looking. You know, if you presume there's nothing out there, you aren't going to look. But, you know, our own concepts about all the planets in the solar system have changed drastically. It wasn't too many years ago. We said that Venus's atmosphere was a tropical paradise, like a jungle with water vapor, because you can't see the surface from here. Well, it's 600-degree atmosphere, and it's sulfuric acid.
I had Seth Shostak on, by the way, a couple days ago talking about this planet.
What did he say?
He admitted, first of all, that you you whipped him in the debate that we had a year and a half or so ago. And but, you know, it's the same thing. Scientifically, he echoes what you're saying about this planet. He's just excited about its possibilities. And apparently SETI did aim their listening devices that way and never picked up anything.
Well, sure, and they did the same with Zeta Reticuli, which is what comes out of the Betty and Barney Hill star map work. But I don't know if I've told this story on the air, but the Germans in 1938 saw that the British were putting up tall towers along the English Channel, over 200 feet high. And since they were working in secret on radar, they figured that that's what the English were doing, and we better find out about it. So they sent the Graf Zeppelin, 700-and-some feet long, cruising along at 70 miles an hour over the channel parallel to the coast of England, looking for radar signals. And you know what? They didn't find any. And they presumed the Brits weren't working on radar. Well, the Brits were. They were just off in the frequency by a factor of 10. Now, if the Germans couldn't figure out what frequency the Brits were using and their technological backgrounds match, in other words, there was a lot of interaction between scientists in both places for the preceding 20 years. Well, not quite 20, but if they couldn't figure out what the Brits were using a few hundred miles away, then how in the world would we Earthlings expect to know what kind of equipment, what frequencies, et cetera, aliens are using 39 light years away? You know, it's very dubious that they'd be stuck at our level of technology, especially since those two stars are a billion years older than the sun. Now, what I haven't seen about this new planet, incidentally, is how old the star is.
They don't know. I asked Seth that question. He didn't know. He said they just don't know if it's older than our sun or younger than it, and he just doesn't know.
Okay. Well, I'll leave it at that. I don't know either. I'm saying there are a lot of variables here, and with us only having radio for a little over 100 years, it's not very likely, to my mind, that we'll be up with everybody out there. I should add that the special thing about Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticulum, constellation of Reticulum in the southern sky, as is this star, incidentally, those two stars are only an eighth of a light year apart from each other. They're 39 light years from here, but they're 35 times closer to each other than the sun is to the next star over. So you can directly observe planets around the other star. We still haven't observed this particular planet, incidentally. We infer its existence from its effect on the path through the heavens of Gliese 581. And so we would expect a greater incentive for interstellar travel when you got a next-door neighbor as opposed to across an ocean, and especially when it's got a billion-year head start on you when it comes to technology.
In 78, you began to investigate Roswell. How did that story come to your attention?
Well, it actually had come to my attention in the early 70s when I talked to a woman named Lydia Sleppy, who had worked at a radio station in Albuquerque back in the 40s. And I called her because her son said she'd had a very good sighting. He was a forest ranger in California, and I was living in California at the time. And he said, you ought to talk to my mom. So I did. Interestingly enough, not only had she had a good sighting, but she was there when their Roswell affiliate called, the radio station down there, called to say that a saucer had crashed and was being sent to Wright Field and tried to dictate a story to put out on the wire. Now, she wasn't a journalist, but she was a very good typist. And she started to put the story out. A bell rang, and it said, do not continue this transmission, FBI. And in case people are wondering, there was more classified work going on in New Mexico than you could shake a stick at. Two of the three nuclear weapons labs are there. White Sands Missile Range was firing captured missiles and all that sort of thing. The biggest employer in the state was Kirtland Air Force Base. And at Roswell, it was the home of the 509th, the people who dropped the atomic bombs on Japan. So anybody, they'd be paying attention. That's where you'd expect spies to be. Anyway, she remembered some of the people. I followed it up over a period of several months and got so far and couldn't go any farther. But that means I was ready in 1978 when I was at a television station in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I was supposed to do three interviews to promote my lecture that night at Louisiana State University, and I'd done the first two. But the third reporter was nowhere to be found, and people didn't have cell phones back then. The station manager, Johnny Allen, is giving me coffee, idle chit-chat. You know, he's looking at his watch. He's all embarrassed. And out of the blue, nothing I said, other than he knew I was there for flying saucers,
sure,
he says, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. And brilliant investigator that I am, I said, who's he? He says, oh, he handled the wreckage of one of those saucers you were interested in when he was in the military.
My. You heard that and your ears popped up.
Yeah, after I picked my teeth up off the floor, I said, well, what do you know about him? Well, he lives over in Houma. I didn't know where that was. It's in Louisiana. And we're old ham radio buddies. You ought to talk to him. And then the reporter showed up. So there was a 20-minute or so window of opportunity.
Right.
Was busy all day. The next day I called Jesse from the airport. He told me a story, didn't have an exact date. I shared that with Bill Moore, whom I'd known in Pittsburgh years before. We had a second story after I spoke in Bemidji, Minnesota, Bemidji State College then. It's now a university. Progress, you know. Anyway, that was about a second sighting that we really went at it. And after that, in the next 2 years, we found 62 people who were involved in the Roswell incident.
Let's come back and we'll talk a little bit more about the apparent aliens at Roswell and whether you think they were also the same type of extraterrestrials involved in the Betty and Barney Hill case. We'll be back. A Monday first hour, my special guest will be actress Pamela Anderson and also Dan Matthews. He's from the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. We're going to be talking about Pam's career, of course, and PETA and their involvement and why they are there to really back up the lives of animals. Dan's new book is called Committed, a rabble-rouser's memoir. So I'm looking forward to that before we get into the full body of the program on Monday with Andrew Collins, who's going to talk about a mystery of one of our constellations up there in space that he says has a lot to do with some of the inhabitants who have visited this planet. So I'm looking forward to that. We'll be back in a moment with Stanton Friedman, our special guest on Coast to Coast AM. Stan, going back to Roswell and then looking ahead to the Betty and Barney Hill case, do you believe that these extraterrestrials were similar, that they might have come from the same star system?
Well, there's no way to judge. They were certainly similar. Small guys, big heads. In the Roswell case, we know four long fingers, upper arm longer than the lower arm, which is the reverse of what it is for us. But, you know, what's an Earthling look like? Maybe he's a tall black Watusi or a short pygmy, you know, but basically humanoid, that is two arms, two legs, a head, and a body. If we have had colonization and migration and an interconnectedness of many stellar civilizations, then they may have be all mixed up and all connected with each other, even though they don't look identical. You know, obviously an Earthling has a bald head, some people would say, but other people would say, hey, what do you mean? I got a big head of hair here, you know.
Yeah.
But we're interconnected. So I don't know. I'll put that one in my gray basket, George.
Now, you mentioned that one of those that you talked to was Jesse Marcel. Now, his
senior,
son,
yes.
Senior.
There's a junior
out there, Dr. Marcel.
He's got a new book coming out, too. Junior does.
What did his father tell him, Stanton?
Well, his father was told by his boss, Colonel Blanchard, to check on what the stuff that a rancher had brought into the sheriff's office. And so Jess went out there, and when he came back, he went out on Sunday, July 6th, came back late on the 7th, stayed overnight out there with a counterintelligence corps guy named Sheridan Cavett. They followed the rancher out. It's about 80 miles, but the last 10 miles at least are cross country. So, you know, we didn't have any GPS out there at the time in 47. So they came back, and Jesse stopped at home late on the 7th with a car full of pieces of stuff, crazy stuff, and he brought some of it into the kitchen, woke up his wife and son, Jesse Jr. And I should add that unlike Peter Jennings, who never bothered to mention that Jesse Jr. is a medical doctor, a pilot, a flight surgeon, and a colonel, he spent a year in Iraq, called in at age 67, would you believe, Jesse handled pieces of the wreckage. He was an only child, as he and his father were close. And he's the one who spotted some of these strange symbols on the little I-beam-like pieces. Anyway, the next morning, I mean, he handled the stuff. He looked at it. They were trying to fit together some of the pieces that were on the floor in the kitchen. The next morning, Jesse Sr. goes to the base on the morning of the 8th of July. And there he gets instructed to take this stuff to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. It was Wright Field at the time. All the base names changed, so it can get a little confusing. But anyway, and he, of course, does as ordered. And he makes a stop at the headquarters of the 8th Air Force, which was in Fort Worth, Texas, right on the way from, if you look at a map, from Roswell to Wright Field. And before it even gotten there, it turns out that Colonel Thomas Jefferson Dubose, who was the chief of staff to the head of the 8th Air Force, General Ramey, Roger Ramey, had already taken a call from Ramey's boss. Now, I mentioned the boss business because this is all chain of command. Blanchard, the head of Roswell, was a West Pointer, as was General Ramey, as was then Colonel Dubose, as was Ramey's boss, General McMullen. And he told Dubose, send some of that stuff up here today with one of your Colonel couriers. Get the press off our backs. I don't care how you do it, and I don't want you ever to talk about it again. So when Jesse arrives, General Ramey tells him, you don't say anything. I'll take care of it. And he did. He said it was just a radar reflector weather balloon combination, which is utterly ridiculous because Jesse had a course in radar and the use of weather balloons for, you know, monitoring conditions in the sky. So when he gets back, Jesse Marcel Sr., he tells the family, don't ever talk about this again. We can't say anything about it. And that was pretty much where it sat. And Jesse being the good son, and this is an Air Force, Army Air Force at that time family. And so he just told them, you know, we can't talk about it and so forth. But Jesse Jr. himself had handled this stuff, and he has made drawings of what the symbols looked like and stuff. And I think we ought to listen to a guy who's a colonel, clearly a loyal citizen, more than 40 years connection with the military, fought in Vietnam, et cetera, and a doctor. And, you know, a flight surgeon, a kind of guy you rely on with very good background. And so Jesse is a little tired of people saying bad things about his father because, naturally, his father died in the mid-'80s. He's not around to defend himself. So he's got a book, Legacy, it's called. It'll be available in Roswell, maybe at where you are. The Roswell Legacy. The son of the first military officer at the 1947 crash site tells his father's story, and I wrote the foreword for the book.
Will Marcel be at Roswell when you're there and I'm there?
Yes, yes, he will be speaking at the museum and taking part in some panels.
Get him on the show
with us, Stanton.
I'm the only
one investigator, anyway, who's been in both his home and his dad's home and home of many of the other witnesses that the Air Force never talked to, even though they say they talked to everybody. So, yes, Colonel Marcel or Dr. Marcel, and which goes first, George? What's the protocol, Colonel or Doctor?
You know, that's a good point. You know, I was in the Navy, and I was just good old Lieutenant George. Good thing my name wasn't Lieutenant Dan, if you can coin a phrase from Forrest Gump, but... get Dr. Marcel for us, and he'll be on that show with us, okay?
Okay, I'll do what I can. I think Jesse and I respect each other. I'm just a couple years older than he is, and he was very appreciative of the fact that I dedicated one of my books to his dad. There are two books, Crash at Corona, the definitive study of the Roswell incident, and then Top Secret Magic about the Majestic 12 stuff, and which says that Roswell happened. And, you know, people sometimes ask me, what's the big deal about Roswell? Well, both the believers and the non-believers think it's very important. If Roswell happened, then clearly in July 1947 we had wreckage, we had bodies, we had clear proof that the planet was being visited, and therefore all the nasty, noisy, negativist arguments fall by the wayside. So naturally it's the target for the debunkers. And, you know, Dr. Bruce Maccabee, an outstanding researcher, he adds his rule to my four basic rules for debunkers. His is, if the first explanation doesn't work, try a second. If that doesn't work, try a third. If that doesn't work, you know, keep going. And so Roswell has had that kind of thing. The Air Force has put out four explanations. I'm waiting for number five, you know.
When we open up the phone lines for the next 2 hours, you would also like to have maybe military veterans come forward and talk about some UFO experiences, maybe based on our dear friend Frank Festino's book, Shoot Them Down. Is that possible?
Well, I hope so. I hope we will have people call. The book highlights, incidentally, the fact that in 1952, orders were given to military people, pilots, to shoot them down, UFOs, if they don't land when instructed to do so. Crazy as that might sound, and you can think of all the cartoons that go with it. And an Air Force general said, we scrambled them hundreds of times. That same general, incidentally, was Roger Ramey. He was now a major general. He was only a brigadier general for Roswell. So Frank has dug out all kinds of stuff about airplane crashes, where the terms the New York Times used included disappeared and disintegrated. And I've heard seven stories of airplanes, more airplanes going up than came back down. And I'm sure that there are still pilots there out alive who are aware of that. Maybe a buddy who went up and whose plane never came back or was found splattered across the countryside. And what I'm hoping is that people will want to get the truth out on the table before they pass on to the next world. And I'm also hoping to take advantage of the fact, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I will, that there's an awful lot of disaffection with the government right now by veterans for the way veterans have been treated.
Good point.
You know, it's not just Walter Reed Hospital, but a whole business about shortchanging them on benefits and all that sort of thing. And, you know, as Colonel DuBose told me when he was in his late 80s, if I remember anything more, Stan, I'll tell you. I like what you're doing. What can they do to me now? You know, interesting question. We'd like to hear from veterans. And my website is www.stantonfriedman.com. It's on your website, I'm sure. And there is an address there. And they can not only order books, papers, DVDs, all that stuff, but it's a place to contact me. I won't give out my phone number right now because we'll be disrupted the rest of the program.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I'm alive, and my phone number is on the website for later, not for during the show. Please, anybody listening.
Tell me about your take on the French government releasing some UFO files.
Well, you know, I did a lot of checking. I was just in San Marino, Italy, and talked to a French researcher, Gildas Bourdais, and he had talked to the guy who's head of the French GIPON files. I'm glad they did it, but I want to correct something. Many of the newspaper articles said it was the stuff was declassified. It was civilian material. It was not declassified because it was never classified. I'm glad to see it, and of course the website went down after 2 hours. 100,000 pages will be eventually on there. Remember that General Carol Bolander, Air Force General, said that reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146, Air Force Manual 55-11, and are not part of the Blue Book system. We certainly have to expect that France, England, Germany, all the rest, that the cases that involve national security, say zapping their airplanes, will not be part of these files. So it's a first big step. I think they were hoping that the United States would release a lot more data, and they said as much in the Comita report. I've got copies of the English translation of that. It's almost 10 years old now, and they stressed the Americans found out all kinds of stuff from Roswell, and they didn't share it with their allies. They were perturbed. So this may be an attempt to stimulate other countries to get their stuff out. I don't know.
Of all the cases you've investigated, besides Roswell, is there one that for you is just the best ever?
Well, I like the Hill case because it's got everything, you know, respectable witnesses, respectable investigators, data that leads us to where these things might come from. It also tells us something else, and it's one of the points covered in the book, that we have the little insight as to how the aliens operate. Remember Betty had a book she was going to take with her?
Right.
And they took it away and said, we have decided. That implies a sort of democratic approach, doesn't it? Their curiosity, the fact that Barney's teeth came out, they were in separate rooms, and they come in and start pulling on Betty's and didn't understand.
Why hers didn't come out.
Yeah, and the fact that they stopped Betty's pain when they stuck this big needle near her navel, they knew enough to stop the pain. So there's a lot of little bits and pieces that haven't been looked at very heavily before that give us some insight into what these guys are like. I don't mean we know their life history or anything like that, George, but still, I like that case. Now, there are a whole bunch of other cases that I deal with in my lectures and stuff, but one of the ones, there is a retired attorney who was a Navy pilot who had a close encounter with UFOs in the early 50s, and where he started to fire his guns, except they hadn't been loaded. this thing was coming right at him, and he was interrogated for hours after that. He had been vectored to go up after a UFO, but the guns hadn't been loaded. And so I like that case just because he and I agreed that probably he wouldn't be alive if his guns had been loaded.
Good point. Good point. You know, Stan, the most recent big UFO case, of course, was once again this one over O'Hare in Chicago.
Yeah.
Were you happy with the coverage that came out over that?
Well, you know, I was very happy with the Tribune's coverage, front page above the fold. I was especially happy with the fact that that story got a million hits on their website, more than any other story they'd ever published about anything, and it led the list for 4 days. It encouraged other media groups and you know, newspapers are losing circulation. The internet is clobbering
right.
Newspapers.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
They were shocked to find that people were actually interested, and the reporter got calls from all over the world. John Hilkovich is to be commended for the fine job that he did. So I think that that had an enormous influence on the coverage that we've had since, on the French stuff being put on the internet, mm-hmm. on Fife Symington's announcement that the former governor of Arizona, that he had seen the Phoenix Lights and considered that they were extraterrestrial and he'd been a pilot. Yeah. Those stories both got far more coverage than they would have if that Chicago Tribune article hadn't appeared and been so well treated and well responded to. So I was delighted with that. What I'm waiting for is Dr. Richard Haynes' report. One of these days he's going to have a report. He's a retired NASA scientist who has been interested in UFOs for 30 years. He's in my movie UFOs Are Real from 1979, mind you, with pilot sightings a specialty. So I think it stimulated a lot of activity, and I'm hoping the media will continue to pay attention to this subject. As a matter of fact, it wouldn't surprise me if this story about the planet got so much coverage, partly because the world, the newspaper world, realizes that people are interested in this stuff.
Exactly. When you were growing up reading UFO stories,
I didn't. I didn't read my first book until I was 24 years old, George.
You're kidding me. Oh, my gosh. I grew up with Frank Edwards. I was a member as a kid of NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. I mean, I was just into all this, Stan. It was just
I read science fiction. I didn't read UFO books because when I was growing up, George, there weren't any.
What made you decide, though, to take this on the road, to go to the universities, which is, again, where I first met you? What made you say, you know what, I'm going to do this and talk about it? You generated an audience that was never there before. How did you talk the universities into even letting you come on?
Well, first, I spoke to a lot of professional groups, and it was Frank Edwards' book, Flying Saucer Serious Business. I had gotten to know Frank in Indianapolis when I worked for General Motors, when I moved to Pittsburgh to work on another canceled program for Westinghouse.
They were all canceled.
Yeah, Frank sent me a copy of the book. I asked him for contacts. I called KDKA Pittsburgh, the contact radio show, and it was one of those, don't call us, we'll call you, and they did call me fairly soon because they'd had a cancellation a half hour before showtime, and I live not too far from the station. My being on that show, my first radio appearance, a woman at work at Westinghouse, technician, had a book review club. They were reviewing Frank's book, and she asked me to speak. And in her living room, I gave my first lecture, Flying Saucers Are Real. I did the radio show a number of times. Was active in our local group, which was connected with NICAP at that time, did a whole bunch of professional groups, especially the Engineering Society of Detroit, which was sold out 3 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for a dinner and a talk, and responded extremely well. I spoke at Los Alamos, the American Nuclear Society section there. Believe it or not, we had 500 people. And when the bottom fell out of the advanced nuclear and space business, I went full-time. Now, I did mailings I'm lazy, haven't done it in a couple of years, to 1,000 or so colleges at a time seeking lectures.
You're good. Stay with us, Dan. We got to take this quick break, and we'll be back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast. And we'll open up the phone lines now for 2 hours as well, and we'll get Stan to finish his story on how he got started in this.